Welcome to episode 31 of the Anthrozoology podcast. This is part one of canine anthropology and considering anthrozoology. I'm Michelle Sidlowski, an anthrozoologist focused on pachyderm human relations and how humans use language to control the narrative of other than human lives.
Hi, my name's Sarah, and I'm looking at shark human relationships. I'm also very interested and did, as part of my master's in anthrozoology, abandoned cats in Saudi Arabia.
Hi, I'm Chris, and my research focuses on cat-human relations and discourses surrounding roaming cats.
And today we are thrilled to welcome Marco Atta to the podcast. Marco is a true Renaissance person, the founder and director of AEDC, which is Anthrozoology Education Dogs, Canines, and INS, which is Integral Neurosoma. Marco is an actor, a scholar in canine-human relationships, an educator, trainer, speaker, coach, and the host of the In the Mouth of the Wolf podcast. Welcome, Marco.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
You have such a diverse background, so maybe we could just start with you giving us a brief overview of how your interest in the field of human and other than human animal relations started.
Well, this goes back to my childhood, right? I grew up in Naples, Italy, in southern Italy. And at that time, I'm talking about the 70s, the 80s, I was a child among free-ranging dogs, literally, because that area was packed of free-ranging dogs at that time. That was a blessing for me because I was leaving my friends from the soccer field and moving to spend some time with free-ranging dogs. I was very inclined and curious about their life, their behavior, and I was observing them, spending a lot of time with them, sitting with them, doing basically what you would say nothing, but actually a lot of things were happening. For my curiosity, my interest, and my feeling, everything was happening around us, me and the dogs, was resonating somehow with something very deeper within myself, right? But at that time, it was just spontaneous. All of that was happening spontaneously, right? However, what I've learned, the lessons I've learned at that time are still accompanying me in my professional life today as a canine enthusiast and working with dogs and wolf passionates and so on. So those were the seeds, those are the roots, right? So then I started to work in some shelters, helping dogs and learning more about dogs. And then at some point, I had to decide, because in life, when you are in your 20s, you need to decide what you're going to do in your life. You know, life, I mean, at least people and the society tells you, you must choose something, right? You cannot do this or you must do this or that. You cannot do both things, right? And so I was in a crisis, right? Because at that, I was already passionate. I was already doing theater at that time, semi-professionally. I'm talking my early 20s and about my early 20s. But I was passionate about animals, and I was also strongly involved in somatic work and martial arts and theater and dance and movement, and right? So I tried to go explore some university courses about animals in veterinary department, in other departments, but nothing of what I found resonated with what I wanted to do with animals, right? It wasn't that clear yet, but I was interested in the psychology, in the cognition, in the emotions, right, of animals. This is in mid-90s. It makes sense because at that time, also globally, there wasn't much about dog canine cognition and so on, right? But in Italy, probably even less. And there was no internet. Can you imagine, right? So also the possibility of exploring other than what I had around myself in Napoli, in Rome, it was very limited, right? But long story short, I took the theatrical career and somatic work career, but I cultivated my interest and studies about animals by myself. And at a certain point, all of that emerged again. I was already in my late 20s, and I started studying again and connecting with other people globally. I came to learn about scientific research on canine cognition and emotion and so on. And then, I stepped into it very clearly, and I started to develop part of my career in with animal behavior alongside my work in theater and somatic training and practices and so on. And then little by little, those fields started to converge. And now I try, jumping 15 years later, 15, 20 years later, I'm trying to integrate those different disciplines, different fields, while in fact I have many connections and there are some common threads in those different fields, right? So it has been a long journey. The roots are in my childhood, but one way or the other, the interest about animals and human-animal interaction unfolded along all of those steps of my career development, interest, studies, and work, and so on, right? So this somehow gives an overview.
Could you just briefly explain? You talked a little bit about somatic practices, and can you just explain a little bit of that for our listeners, what you mean by that, and how you've incorporated that into the human other than human relations?
So let's say that under the somatic practice umbrella, we can put all of many disciplines, many way of working with your body, right? Maybe it for performing reasons, may it be for psychosomatic healing and elaboration of trauma. Maybe it, like for example, yoga. Maybe it for studying martial arts. So let's say all of those somatic tools that allow you to understand at a deeper level through your body, through movement, who you are, how you interact with others, humans, and how you interact with other animals, may be the case too, right? And how you interact with nature and how nature interacts with you, right? Somatic, so is the soma, the body, that becomes the gate through which you look at yourself to understand better yourself within the community you are part of course. It's at the same time individual and collective work that you do through the body, right? And so I've been exposed to various disciplines since my childhood too, starting with the martial arts and then later other yoga came and other disciplines came into the picture. And most recently, actually already early in 2000, when I was chief at the department of a theater in Rome, and I was in the part I was chief of the educational department. So I was designing and leading some projects for actors and integrating some social groups into the work of actors. So helping some people coming from immigration, from women taken away from the prostitution circle, or people coming from prisons, and children with difficulties, adolescents at risks, all the different demographics. We were integrating those to the work of actors, and they were working together. So it was an opportunity for actors to explore more nuance of human behaviors, and it was an opportunity for those people to interact with others, to get exposed to other people, to get rehabilitated somehow, to being supported, I would say, in their process. And at that time already, it happened that somebody was coming with a dog, right? And so we were allowing, at certain point, I asked to people to allow the dog to move freely in the space. We were in a theater room, right? And to allow the dog to move freely in the theater space and ask to everybody to not interact, not interfere with what the dog was doing, right? And those were the initial spontaneous attempts of integrating a dog in the somatic work. I mean, people working in the room and exploring their body, exploring their voice, and the dog interacting with them. Interacting sometimes means simply moving from a corner to another of the room, or going to lick somebody while somebody was crying, or going to wag the tail to somebody else while something was happening in the room, right? So, and those were the first spontaneous and experiments where dogs were being integrated into somatic work. And more recently, I've started to develop, or let's say, propose a drafting. I started to draft a model where we can integrate dogs into some somatic work workshops and somatic workshops. And dogs, actually, we have and done a bit more carefully, observing specifically the behavior of the dog. And that can actually bring some interesting elements to the picture and interesting points of transformation to the participants of that workshop. For now, I'm calling these canine participated somatic experiencing. And it's just at the beginning of this idea. And I've done a few workshops integrating some dogs in the process of people within a certain place, working on body and movement and so on. I believe it's promising. It's very interesting what happens. And so this is one of the main, for example, connecting points where theater, somatic work, and canine cognition and behavior and emotion may merge, may interact at some level, right?
It seems like the dogs probably would have an easier time because they're very body aware, body focused, body language focused, that they might have an easier time than the humans. Did the humans have trouble not falling into a human trap of automatically wanting to call the dog and call, get him over and
Yeah,
want?
absolutely. It's actually one of the main challenges in those situations is to really reiterate continuously to people to not interfere with what the dog is doing. Not to not interact, it wouldn't be fair to say that, because you can just stand and not doing anything to the dogs, but you feel the presence of the dog and you are somehow interacting in that way, right? But to not interfere, to be observant of what the dog is doing in the space. And so this allows at least two main things. First and foremost, to provide a dog with agency. So you're not asking, you're not expecting for the dog to do something, but you're allowing the space and time for the dog to express herself or himself. And secondly, you are providing people with a sort of education or psychoeducation or whatever you want to put it, helping people to understand and that they do not need to do anything to communicate with the dog, right? Which is, but they need to listen, they need to be present to it, but they don't have to do any particular action, or they do not. They don't need to ask any particular, give any particular command or do any particular request to dogs, because the dog can choose by himself or herself what may be needed in that particular situation, right? And that links well to to my work, for example, as a dog, a behavior consultant. When I enter to the house, into the house of people, and because maybe they call me for because the dog is showing these behavioral issues, all of a sudden everything is getting out of control. Okay, let's see, let's investigate a little bit what's going on here. Let's dive into the family history. Let's see who is involved in the family, who are the people in of this family, who lives in the house, what may be going on within that family, right? Because actually, dogs, as we all know here, but it's better to remind that dogs sometimes present some issue, while in fact they are mirroring some imbalance that is present within the whole family, right? So they are what we call in psychology identified patients, right? So patients, so they manifest a sort of imbalance which is within that family system, right? So we need to investigate what's going on within that family system and why the dog may be mirroring and what the dog may be mirroring. And so also in that case, to go back to what we were saying before, also in that case, we help people understanding that they don't have to do much. that the dog is not necessarily the problem, that the dog is part of a system, that what may need to be addressed within that situation is the behavior of people sometimes, and maybe we need to be less claiming toward the dogs and more observant of our own behavior. And then naturally, sometimes very naturally, the situation goes back in balance just by changing the behavior of people, right? So yeah, I stretched it a little bit, but I hope this is useful anyway.
So I actually have a little story I want to share that's going to lead into a question. So just bear with me while I ramble on about cats as usual. So I mean, I a bit like you, I learned about cats just by being with cats and making cat friends out and about. And I actually visited Naples, and I went down to the archaeological sites, Pompeii and Herculaneum, somewhere I always wanted to visit. I visited there in 2016. It was right at the beginning when I started the MA in Amphrozoology course, so I was starting to think sort of more about these relationships. But I've always sort of taken pictures of cats I meet out and about, and I have a whole massive file full of cats, cats in archaeological at Pompeii Herculaneum. And I also made a little dog friend too. He followed me around the site at Herculaneum, and I'm pronouncing that wrong, aren't I? Is it Herculaneum?
Ercolano, Ercolano. It's okay, it's fantastic, you know.
Yeah, that's so I found it really interesting that, yeah, you said you learned about dogs from interacting with free roaming dogs as a child, and that actually. So my research into cat human relations are discourses surrounding free roaming in cats. So a prominent theme that emerged was discourses surrounding this kind of cats versus dog, mostly light-hearted banter, but there was also this kind of underlying serious tone. But what was prominent in my data sets was this notion that dog guardians are more responsible and that dogs don't roam. And I understand that that's like a reflection, that it really is a reflection of my sample demographic, which was almost exclusively Anglo-centric, so like UK, US, Canada, bit of Australia. And I find it curious that the idea that dogs, free roaming companion dogs or free living dogs, are sort of a big part of a lot of cultures around the world, but it was just like this idea in this demographic that dogs need to be controlled in the home, on the leash. Good responsible dog owners, not like those cat owners that let the cats run about pooping in everybody's garden. Kind of that was a big part of the discourses that came out of that. So yeah, there's this idea, and it's an Anglo-centric idea, I guess, is the best way to describe it, that dogs are or should be controlled, and this isn't even questioned. And yeah, so I wondered if you could comment a bit on the cultural differences. From communities where dogs have more freedom, whether they're sort of free roaming companion dogs that go out about in the day, come back, or just, yeah, street dogs. And yeah, what do you think? Yeah, is this healthier for the dogs?
Well, many questions into that,
Yeah,
right?
sorry.
So, no, it's okay. So first, it's very common, and it appears in many cultures that people believe that dogs are the best friends, human best friends. So they need to live with people, and they are somehow domestic or tameable somehow. And cats are feral animals that cope with being with humans somehow, but actually they're feral in their nature, right? That's a very common belief, right? A very common, people in many cultures, you may find that, at least I found that in Europe, I found that in South America, in Central America, in Indonesia, in places where I've been traveling, studying and living, in different places and cultures, I found that traits, right? So it really depends on where we put the frame and what is in within that frame that it may make the difference, right? But and then there are other ways to frame things, of course. Regarding to dogs, for example, dogs are not necessarily humans' best friend, and especially we may say that in many places, as you were also mentioning, in many places around the world, Many dogs live as free-ranging animals, right? And they, in many cases, those free-ranging dogs live a very happy life, let's say, from their point of view, right? So to go back to your other question, is that healthy for the dog to be, if I got it right, to be considered as those who have to live with humans at any cost? Is absolutely is not always a good deal for them. It's actually a torture for them in many cases, right? Especially when they are removed from their free lifestyle, free, happy, well-balanced lifestyle, and they are relinquished, and they are put into a shelter, or they are shipped to the other side of the world in name of animal welfare, for example, to be adopted by some families in believing that those dogs have to be removed from the street, while in fact they live well, a good life from their point of view, from an animal point of view, from a dog point of view. They live a very happy life there. And so it's not a good deal for them to be saved and shipped on the other side of the world and being very traumatized in many ways and then having a very horrible life, sometimes even being euthanized because they are not able to be reintegrated into such a different environment, for example, right? I believe that happens in some cases for cats and other animals too, right? So there are many delicate points in your questions, which of course it would be wonderful to keep discussing it. These and other opportunities, occasions, right? Sarah wants to say
I guess
something.
really
Go
quick,
ahead.
I guess it just comes back to individuality, right? So that you can't say what's like I keep coming back to what's people always say what's best for cats, and that's not
Yeah,
the question. It's
absolutely.
what's best for this cat, and the
Yeah.
same with dogs, right? It's sort of what is good for one dog is not the best for another. And yeah, I just find it fascinating how people have these fixed ideas about other animals that they don't question. Sort of a lot of my the discourses in my data set, they just never question that dogs are happier on leads, kept under control, and that's just the way they've lived with dogs, and their neighbors live with dogs in the neighborhood and the dog park. And and that's not how a lot of the world lives, and they're not unhappy necessarily.
Yeah.
So if I can pick up on that, Chris, and obviously to Marco, so when you were talking about the dogs where you grew up and the free-ranging dogs, that obviously brought me to wondering a couple of things. One, if they're still there, but also it reminded me, and what Chris was saying about the different cultures and the conflicts in cultures. I've lived in the UK, I've lived in Thailand for a while, I lived in Saudi for quite a long time, and I've lived in Port. Now I'm living in Portugal, and each of those, you can see the cultural tensions underlying the norms of how the animals are treated or considered in those cultures versus the overlaying of different cultural expectations from people who are coming from outside those countries and coming in, and with them bringing their cultural judgments. And the of course, the people who are not asked in all this are the animals themselves, the cats, the dogs, in quite often are the main ones that are living on streets or outside of homes, whether they're called free ranging, free roaming, whatever, you know, there's lots of different terms as we're aware of. And it made me think about the term that you coined, which is anthropozoology, because in each of these countries, I know for sure I have, and I'm sure that many other people in those countries have experienced this idea of anthropozoology, because we all where people come in from the outside and they judge whether an animal is better on the street or off the street, and I know there are different arguments for both. There are also various groups or individuals that see the and you mention it in your paper, recognizing anthropozoology, about the abuse that animals can receive while they're free roaming, free ranging, and of course that can also happen in the home. And it made me also think of my work with abandoned cats in Saudi. And I kind of find this, I don't know if there's another word you can coin, but it's kind of this like a inner freak out when somebody judges immediately that all cats should live indoors, or all cats should live outdoors, or all dogs should live indoors, or all the, there's this judgment without, as you say, these particular nuances. So there's this little inner in a, I don't know, like a critique of or a peak of anthrozoology. But also, I was wondering if you could comment on some of that, perhaps. But also, have you coined, or should there be coined, a term for the animals who are involved in these situations that are caught up in this maelstrom of human judgments of where they should be living? I don't know, zoology, or I don't know if there is such a term, but I wondered if you considered, the other side of the, of course, you probably have the other side of how the animals actually, apart from our pain and stress and anxiety, but their collective pain, stress, and anxiety.
Yeah, so you say from the animal perspective, right? If there is a, absolutely, we should make these we should work on this together. Yeah, we
Would
should work on
love
this
to.
together.
We should
Yeah, we should
definitely.
work on this together. So actually, the need for coming up with anthrozoology, it was to acknowledge the struggle of people, right? Of people suffering for animals, right? Which to some extent intrinsically is already highlighting the struggles of animals too, because if you struggle, if somebody is mourning the loss of an icon animal, for example, even without having met that icon animal, but that icon animal now, let's say the case of a lion or whatever animal, killed by a hunter just for the heck of, right? So he's intrinsically integrating also the suffering of animals. However, what you're saying is very important, is relevant, because I've been wondering about that. To what extent we should make these more touchable, more clear, more evident, more explicit, simply explicit, right? And I believe in keep working on anthrozoology and expanding, if we can collaborate on that, and that may be starting point. And anyway, anthrozoology, it's very incomplete in the way it has been proposed, right? It's just let's say the beginning, I believe, of something that can be explored way further. Like, for example, as I clarified in the paper too, I named 10 possible ways of framing what can be under the umbrella, what can go under the umbrella of anthrozoology, but that's no way exhaustive, in any way exhaustive, of the many cases that can be integrated into under that umbrella, the many ways in which we can recognize human sufferings for animal suffering, right? So in that sense, it's implicit, but we can make that more explicit for sure, right? And yeah, it's I believe it may be useful to keep working on that. I'm grateful that you are somehow interested in that, and I believe we can move together ahead if you want in that sense.
Sorry, I have one additional question. So, as I'm sure we have all experienced, we see these tensions between people who are arguing about animals, and they're saying, and some groups are more forgiving, more compassionate about how they address other people who are arguing about these particular situations. But it seems that sometimes there's just a brick wall where certain people don't want to change their entrenched views. For example, at the moment, there's a group, and I won't say which country for anonymizing purposes, but this particular group has this idea of how dogs should be adopted without considering, they're not interested in having any input from the experiences of other people who've been through, who've worked with adopting dogs for a long period of time, or other animals, for example. And there's a very strong sense of, well, they explicitly say, we're not listening to others, and this is how we're going to do it, and we don't care if other people are right or wrong. And that's the other question is like there's almost an anthropology for that as well. It's like, how do we change? How do we, yes, we can change, we can have drive, we can have passion, we can write things, we can do things, we can speak, but still there are these little monoliths of entrenchment that actually prevent improving lives for animals. But these monoliths think they are improving lives for animals. So it's just one of those things, the general discussion really is it's just so difficult. I don't think any of them have an answer. It's just so difficult getting through those barriers sometime.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I understand the concern. I understand that feeling of being unquiet, while you say, you think, okay, I'm putting all of the effort in trying to bring ahead this type of idea, this type of value, and I have those guys there, or those girls, whoever it may be, that are doing something that is completely against what I'm doing. So you feel, but this is the way I approach this. We need to think to the ultimate game, I would call it. We need to have a broad perspective, and we need to do the best we can do according to our value, our values today, to bring ahead the ideas, the values, the concept, the practice, the good practices that we believe in, right? And being aware that the work we do today, it's a piece of a puzzle that we may never see in our own life because it's part of a process. It's a humanity process. It takes generations for things to go ahead, to move forward, to change, and so on, right? As what we can enjoy today, the benefits of what the declaration of animal consciousness as the foundation of the work that some people have done 40 years before, right? So, which who are no longer around, for example, right? So, we need to stick with our values and what we believe in and move ahead with the work we have to do, regardless of what others are doing. However, we can try to have a dialogue. If they are willing to, if they are to, and maybe integrate some parts of our work and maybe finding new ways when there is openness. And if not, we need to be optimistic, go ahead with our work, find who is similar to you, and growing the conversation with people that understand what are your values and what you want to do. And then life will do the rest, must do the rest somehow, right? So this is my approach to that.
It sounds like a much more mentally healthy way to approach the situation. But I think for a lot of people that suffer from this anthropology, it's because you can't wait, right? If you're dealing, like I deal with elephants, if you're dealing with elephants, elephant conservation, we don't have 40 years, right? That we won't have any left. Cheetahs, other species that are rapidly disappearing. I think that that's where some of this sort of compassion fatigue comes from, is this sense of urgency. So rather than seeing yourself as part of the bigger puzzle, you have this feeling like I have to do something right now. And I think that's where some of that conflict comes from as well, because you have people that don't know what they're doing, right? They want to help a species with no experience with that species, so they jump in a way that is maybe more harmful. But yeah, it is hard to avoid those feelings of anxiety and stress and pain if you're dealing with a species that's likely to be gone.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe those are complementary, what we are saying. That degree of urgency is always there. It must be there because animals maybe are in struggles, are struggling with some situation. What about, for example, a teenager that is experiencing, some sort of anthropozoology and in a 2 days maybe take his life or her life. What type of urgency should we have with that? Of course, there is a level of urgency that we always have to be at the top, right? And of course, that creates a certain degree of anxiety and stress for ourselves, right? So we need to integrate that urgency with the trust that what we are doing and the best that we are doing today, it will bring a benefit to whatever scenario we are considering, right? And with the, at least this is my approach, with the awareness, with being conscious of the fact that you may not be, it may take some time, that the effort that you are, the best effort that you're putting into that today may resonate you and your community, your people, people who are supporting your work, people who are on the same side of the barricade, may bring some benefits with time, right? And again, of course, we need to be very aware of all the struggles that are happening today, but being trustful, put the best into it, and being trustful that time hopefully will bring something good.
I think that's good advice. It's something I need to think more about and really take
Yes.
part. So it's good to hear that reminder.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we all of us here, and maybe our listeners, are affected by anthropology to some extent.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Anthrozoology podcast. And thank you especially to our guest, Marco Atta. References mentioned within can be found in our show notes. And please make sure to join us for episode 32, where we continue our conversation about canine anthropology and anthrozoology with Marco.